This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, our guests include the former governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, who will be in Louisiana and, of course, remains active in American politics. He is now a Democrat after being an elected official as a Republican. Also on the show, Lee Wesley, the pastor of the Plymouth Rock Church, the Baptist Church in Plaquemine, where 50 years ago, major events were taking place, and there will be a commemoration of what happened in Plaquemine at Plymouth Rock coming soon, and we'll talk to Pastor Wesley about this, along with Linda Johnson, the former Bessie board member, who is involved in this 50-year anniversary. And Zach Coplin, the noted activist who is fighting Louisiana Science Education Act, we'll get an update from him. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. The email address to reach us is inkstershow@wrkf.org. In studio are Pastor Lee Wesley of the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church in Plaquemine, and Linda Johnson, a longtime Board of Elementary and Secondary Education member. She's no longer on the Bessie Board, but she knows her town of Plaquemine quite well. And this month there is a commemoration of events surrounding what happened in Plaquemine in 1963, August of 1963. That was the month in which Martin Luther King delivered his stirring address at the mall in Washington, August 28th, and in Plaquemine, things were going on that were a bit unsettling, and Lee Wesley and Linda Johnson are here to talk about what happened there and how it relates to what was occurring in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pastor Wesley, let's begin with you. What was occurring in Plaquemine in August of 1963 that you will be commemorating in a few days?
In August of 1963, Plaquemine was a hotbed for civil rights activities in the state of Louisiana. As a matter of fact, Plaquemine was the site that was selected by Corps to train their members and other volunteers that were sent out to other parts of the state of Louisiana in a voter registration drive. James Former, who was at the time the national director of Corps, had come to Plaquemine for a rally that was held at the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church. And when the powers that be heard he was coming to town, they actually came to the church looking for him, threw tear gas canisters into the church, rode horses into the church with cattle prods, and of course the crowd dispersed. The parsonage was right behind the church. Some of the folk went there. They were pursued by the law enforcement officers. They ended up going to Citizens Mortuary, which was adjacent to the parsonage, and there is where they sought James Former, and they ended up actually putting him in a casket in a hearse in order to get him out of town. So we'll be commemorating those activities.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with Pastor Wesley and Linda Johnson. And this was 50 years ago. It may be hard for some of us to believe that these kinds of things were occurring in our midst not so long ago. Many people, of course, were still alive and have memories of this time. The reference to CORE, that's the Congress of Racial Equality, and James Former was the leader. And that organization was at the forefront of integration and civil rights, and some folks in this area, believe it or not, didn't like that very much.
Well, some folk did not want blacks to register and vote, and that was all a part of the problem. It was there in Plaquemine that they had come to launch this voter registration drive. Sort of took another direction because of some of the activity that was going on at the time. Former actually was scheduled to speak at the rally in Washington and could not get there because he was in jail in Donaldsonville at the time.
Yeah, when he was carried out in a hearse, he wasn't dead. He was put in jail in Donaldsonville. What happened there?
He could have bonded out, but his reasoning was, if I bond out, then how's that going to look to the other local folk who were in jail? So he selected to remain in jail with them until all of them could be bonded out.
And he responded by saying upon his release, quote, all hell broke loose. What happened?
And it did. As I say, it was really a hot spot. Those who were in power at the time did everything that they could do to resist changes in the city of Plaquemine.
When we're talking about changes, so what kinds of changes we're talking about? Registering to vote, things like that, that are just basic rights that we often assume that, go with being a citizen.
Rights that should have come to us simply because we're citizens of the United States of America, including voter registration, including being able to shop where we want to shop, to eat what we want to eat in terms of integration and going to the schools where we wish to go to schools. So you were talking about doing away with the Jim Crow laws at the time, which, as you know, were resisted by this state and by the local communities across the state of Louisiana.
Well, Farmer was not the only one who went to jail. There were several.
No, a lot of the locals went to jail. The pastor of Plymouth Rock at that church was Reverend Judson Davis. He went to jail. Ronnie Moore, who was a part of CORE and CORE's main individual in Plaquemine, went to jail as well as hundreds of citizens of the city of Plaquemine.
Now, as you note, James Farmer was slated to speak at the March on Washington, and he had the financial resources to come up with the $500 to bail himself out, but he didn't have the money to bail out everybody else, so he decided to stay in jail rather than go to Washington.
Which was a wise decision on his part,
Why?
I believe.
Why was that
well,
a wise decision?
It would have seemed that he was deserting, if you will, the cause by going to Washington, D.C. and leaving the locals in jail, and he did not want to give that impression.
So he was watching, along with many others, reportedly on a small black-and-white television when Martin Luther King delivered the I Have a Dream speech August 28th, 1963.
Absolutely.
Martin Luther King also spent a lot of time in this area during those years, didn't he?
Matter of fact, it was Reverend T.J. Jemison, who was then pastor of the Mount Zion Baptist Church, had led a very successful bus boycott in Baton Rouge. I was young at the time, but remember that. And King actually came to meet with Dr. Jemison to get the plan for the bus boycott that later he held with Rosa Parks.
Now, you have some events coming in the next few days, August 23rd and 25th specifically, to commemorate the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church events of 1963. I would think this would be the kind of thing that Governor Jindal and U.S. Senator David Vitter, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, that they would attend. Do you have any indication that the major leaders of our state will be there?
We have not reached out to them. Mrs. Johnson really has been the one planning the program and has been in touch with those persons, by the way, who were here in 1963 will be coming back. Some were residents of Plaquemine at that time that literally had to leave town, but they'll be coming back. She's spoken with them, and she can speak more directly to who they are and whether or not she has reached out to Senator Vitter, Senator Landrieu, our Honorable Governor Jindal, and or if she anticipates reaching out to them.
All right. Linda Johnson, why don't you come to the microphone? There will be events a week from Friday, August 23rd, and another one the following Sunday, the 25th. But what happens on the 23rd, and who do you think will be there as far as public officials, Linda?
I'm not really sure that there are any public officials who will be there because it has not been our, we have not reached out to them personally.
You wouldn't complain if they came, would you?
Oh, no, it's a public event. And it's been, and it is today being publicized. It has been in the local papers, so anybody can come. It is a commemoration of events that were horrific during that time. So on the panel, the educational panel on the 23rd at 7 o'clock at Plymouth Rock Baptist Church, we will have Ronnie Moore. Ronnie was the coordinator for CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, in Louisiana at that time. We'll also have Dr. Lance Hill from Tulane University, who has compiled a lot of information concerning the civil rights events of the 60s. And we will have Taurus Armstead, who was one of the people consistently arrested during that time.
All right. So where will you meet on the 23rd?
Plymouth Rock Baptist Church, Iron Farm Road in Plaquemine.
Now, the old church was on Front Street, right?
On Court.
Oh, excuse me, on Court Street, which is a main drag. 297-5633. Charles on North Foster, Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Pastor Wesley and Linda Johnson.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning to your guests. I'm here in Baton Rouge, and I'd like to ask your guests, considering that African Americans were denied their voting rights and that a number of city and parish charters in Louisiana were created while these rights were denied, how do they feel today about acknowledging the fact that these city charters and parish charters are unconstitutional by the very fact that all Americans were not allowed to vote now?
Well, I think it's obvious that since the 50s, a whole lot has changed. There's still much work to be done. I think the thing that we have to be aware of as African Americans that what we're fighting now are laws, unjust laws that are being passed, not only at the local level, but the state level as well, that if we aren't careful, the hand of time will reverse itself. For example, the Stand Your Ground law, it's a law, but it's an unjust law. And unless we get involved in the political process to change the laws that are being put on the book, we're going to find ourselves back where we were 50 mm-hmm. years ago or more.
Do you recall the first time you voted?
I recall the first time I voted, yes.
When was that?
Right after I turned 18 years old. Don't recall who I voted for at the time.
What year was it?
That would have been 63.
1963.
About 63, yes.
Well, there was a Louisiana governor's race in early 64. Then we were doing our elections at different times, but that was John McKithen and others. But did you have any problems when you tried to vote?
I experienced no problem whatsoever. Matter of fact, I voted for Big John McKithen at that time, as
you did?
I recall. Yes, you I did.
Linda, yeah. What about you?
I've turned 18, and as soon as I turned 18, I registered and I voted. I have never had any difficulty voting. I have to admit that. I have always voted. I think that if someone were to check my record, which I'm sure they did when I was on Bessie, I don't mm-hmm. miss voting.
All right. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Still time to get in with Lee Wesley and Linda Johnson. Carlos at Southern University. Hi, hello, Carlos.
Hello, Jim. How are you guys today?
Fine.
Great. I had the pleasure of living in Plaquemine for about 5 years. From 2007 to 2012, and Ms. Johnson was my neighbor. And prior to that, I taught African American Studies at LSU, and you know, being over in Plaquemine, which is, you know, the rural part of the Capital Region, it astonished me the lack of commemorational signs or images associated with the African American presence there. However, Ms. Johnson was kind enough to acclimate me to the history of the place that's so rich in historical events and facts. And so I would just hope that at some point there would be a commemoration as visible as the Veterans Memorial, as some of the other memorials there in the city, because it's a beautiful, quaint town that certainly needs to embrace all of its history. So I'm very happy to that this is going on there and hope to attend next week.
Also, we hope you'll spread the word for us out at Southern University. One of the reasons for the educational forum on the 23rd is to pass on our history to our young people. Most of them do not have a clue as to what transpired 50 years ago, and just assume that some of the rights that they are enjoying now have always been enjoyed by the black community, and that is not so. So pass the word for us. Also, we hope out of this will come a permanent museum in the city of Plaquemine where our young people can go and receive on a continuous basis information about the 60s.
We have a question from Cassidy wanting to know what happened to Mr. Farmer.
Jim Farmer, when he left Plaquemine, continued to work with CORE. He is a professor, so he also was the professor in residence at a number of universities. Diabetes became very prevalent in his life, mm-hmm. and he lost his vision, and he lost one of his legs, and he eventually died.
All right, 297-5633 is your number outside our area. Please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We will return with Linda Johnson and Pastor Lee Wesley coming next week. There will be a 50-year commemoration of volatile events in the nice Hamlet of Plaquemine, 1963. We'll be back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757, your number, wherever you are, as we rejoin Pastor Lee Wesley and Linda Johnson, formerly with the Bessie Board. They are citizens of Plaquemine, and come a week from today, actually a week from Friday, there will be a major event at the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church commemorating what occurred in Plaquemine 50 years ago in August of 1963, leading up to the March on Washington, August 28, 1963. What was it like for life in Plaquemine in those days? Were there segregated facilities, Linda?
Yes. In Plaquemine in 1963, we had like no clerks working in, no black clerks working in any of the department stores or any of the grocery stores, the major grocery stores. We had a store called Food Town. It was one of the stores that was picketed heavily in Plaquemine because of that, because we all shopped there, but we didn't have anybody working in it. We also had, and you'd have to go to the courthouse, have had to go to the courthouse to see this, something that is unbelievable to children today, and it was signs that said white water and colored water. And if you talk to kids today, they'll ask you, well, what was colored water? Was it different? What color was it? They also had signs, if I wanted food from the Dairy Queen, I had to go around to the back to get it, to order it. So a lot of things just were very segregated. Also, in the school system, the books that I used were books that had been previously used by students at Plaquemine High. We always got, and this is not a really truly bad thing, because they were books, but they were not the current books.
And I suspect the school system was segregated as well.
Very segregated. During this time, and I'm sure you're aware of what has happened, we were under a desegregation suit for 37 mm-hmm. years, much like what happened in Baton Rouge.
Well, even today, there is segregation largely by choice. For example, Pastor Wesley, I doubt that there are very few white folks in your congregation at Plymouth Rock Baptist Church.
None. But that's by choice.
By choice.
That's by choice.
Is that good?
If they choose to come, we'd welcome them. I also passed in Baton Rouge, where we do have white members of that congregation. I think people ought to be able to worship where they want to worship. And if they choose to worship a predominantly black church and you're white, I think that's good, or vice versa. So a person has a right to worship where he wishes to worship, and certainly our congregation is open to that.
What about neighborhoods? Are the neighborhoods integrated?
There are some neighborhoods in Plaquemine where you do have a mix of black and white, yes.
Some, but that the norm?
But primarily, the blacks live in one area of town and the whites live in another area.
And that's the way it is in Baton Rouge.
Same thing in Baton Rouge,
many
yes.
progressives around the LSU campus, they live in all-white neighborhoods.
That is correct, but again, by choice.
By choice.
By choice. Yeah.
But how can you be progressive if you're living in an all-white or an all-black neighborhood?
I think in time that's going to change, and I think it is changing gradually now. So there's a culture connected to that as well. I have one of my pastor friends here in Baton Rouge who pastors in a community that is a transitional community. And they were reaching out to the blacks who live in that area, which is now about 85% black. Some would come to the church, but none would join the church. And he asked, what are your thoughts here? And I said to him, it has nothing to do with color. It has something to do with culture. You don't worship the way we worship. You don't sing the way we sing. You don't preach the way we preach. So it's not because you're white and they don't like you because you're white. It's because there's a difference in the culture of our worship. So you're going to always have those cultural differences.
There's also something else that I think you need to be very much aware of in the city of Plaquemine. We have probably the largest number of chemical industry in our area, but we also have the highest amount of poverty. So poverty affects greatly where people live.
Certainly. Well, we had Paul Nockan on this show not so long ago. He and Steve Myers have been in a fight in Baton Rouge over an ordinance that is now being determined as to its legitimacy in the courts. But Mr. Nockan was commenting about his neighborhood, and he lives on Morning Glory, being all white, And he said with a straight face on this show that black folks didn't have the money to live in his neighborhood. That's not necessarily true, is it?
That may not be true for everybody, but there is a large segment of people who don't make probably enough money to move to certain neighborhoods. We have a tremendous amount of poverty in Plaquemine. That has not changed since 1963.
But you're telling me there's not one white person or one black person who has the capacity to move into one of these segregated neighborhoods?
Oh, well, I'm not saying that, because I live in a neighborhood that's mixed.
Right.
And so, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that poverty does affect the degree to which people move.
297-5633. But I think the overriding message is that here we are 50 years past 1963, and things aren't as bad as they were then, but we still have largely segregation by choice.
Yeah, the laws have changed. The economics in many areas, in many cases, has not changed. And because of that, you just can't afford to live in, blacks can't afford to live in certain areas. But again, I think the key is laws ought not prevent people from living where they wish to live or going to a restaurant where they wish to dine. Laws ought not prevent that. People will always have choice, but their choices are going to be affected by the economics as well.
But 50 years ago, we had segregated lunch counters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And certainly in Baton Rouge, and my guess in Plaquemine as well, and all over the South, and in many parts of the United States. This is something that no longer exists, thank goodness.
I can remember Piccadilly on 3rd Street as a boy.
Really?
And going downtown, and there was a big glass window, and looking into Piccadilly, seeing folk who look like you enjoying a meal and wishing I could go in and enjoy one with them. I could not, but today I can go to Piccadilly.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. But you couldn't go to a Piccadilly on 3rd Street?
I could not, no.
Were black people allowed to work there?
Yes. Most of the people there, not most, but quite a few of them, were black. Not as waitresses, as bus boys, bus girls, as folk who cleaned the place up. But we still could not go there and dine.
Well, it is interesting that in some establishments it's okay for black folks to work and clean the dishes, but they can't come out and dine with the rest of people.
There's a rationale that I have never been able to understand. In those days, blacks could not eat with whites, but we could prepare the food that the whites ate. We could not mix with whites publicly, but we could raise the children of whites and work in their homes. It didn't make good common sense.
Mm-hmm. And we had a man for president, or ran for president, in 1948, Strom Thurmond, who had fathered a biracial child with a maid in his family home, and yet his one issue when he ran for president of the United States was segregation.
Yes, yeah. It's the hypocrisy of those days, and that hypocrisy still exists today.
Okay. So what will happen a week from Sunday at Plymouth Rock Baptist Church?
On that Sunday, we will gather at Plymouth Rock at 2 o'clock. We will board a bus, buses, and go to the old location of Plymouth Rock Baptist Church on Court Street, where we have erected a historical marker. We'll gather around that marker. We'll sing some of the songs of the movement, have a prayer. Then we will be bused toward the new location and actually march from where the buses will take us to the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church. There's a bell outside of Plymouth Rock Baptist Church. We'll call the name of 50 individuals who are now deceased, who were involved in the movement. We'll ring the bell 50 times in their memory. Then we'll enter the sanctuary where we will actually have the program. Spiva Garden, who was one of the local leaders at the time, who literally had to move out of Plaquemine, out of Louisiana, as a matter of safety, will come back, and he'll be the keynote speaker for that program.
Well, thank you, Pastor Lee Wesley, Plymouth Rock Baptist Church, and Linda Johnson.
Thank you.
For remembering what happened in Plaquemine 50 years ago and what's occurring in our midst today.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share with the public.
Thank you. And we're joined now by the former Florida governor, Charlie Crist. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Jim. How are you today?
Doing well. Good to hear your voice. And you will be coming.
Yours as well.
You'll be coming to Louisiana in a few days.
Yeah, we are looking forward to it. I got a very kind invitation from the new chairman, Senator Karen Carter Peterson, and my wife and I are looking forward to coming to New Orleans, having some good food, and talking about some great Democratic politics.
What kind of food do you like?
I like everything. I particularly like oysters, though, and seafood generally. And so I'm looking forward to being in the quarter and experiencing some more of that.
You're of Greek descent, aren't you?
I am. My grandfather, Adam Christodoulos, immigrated to America when he was 14 years old, back in 1912, and he came by himself, and he didn't have any money, but he had a dream of coming to the new country of America and having an opportunity to do well. And the first job he got was in Altoona, Pennsylvania, and he shined shoes for a living, making $5 a month, which is pretty amazing.
$5 a month. What year would that have been?
That would have been in 1912.
1912, 101 years ago. So it's heady stuff for a man such as you, born in 1956 in Pennsylvania, to become the governor of the great state of Florida, an office you held from January of 2007 until January of 2011. Your political rise was as a Republican. What prompted you early on to be a member of the GOP?
To be honest, I was born in the Republican Party. My mom and dad were Republican. They actually still are. You know, most of the people that I knew in St. Petersburg, Florida were Republican. And it's almost like choosing a religion, you know. You know, your mother and father are of a certain party, and you associate with that philosophy. And it was sort of a different time in the GOP, to be honest with you, too, Jim. It was more of a bigger tent party, and of late, I think the Republican leadership, at least, has become much more strident, to my sadness, and really caused me to become a Democrat, and I just feel a lot more comfortable where I am now.
Do you recall the first presidential election you voted in?
Vividly. It was 1976. I was a student at Florida State University in Tallahassee, and I'll never forget it because it was Ford versus Carter. And at about noon on that day, I realized I hadn't yet voted. And another friend of mine at FSU, also from St. Petersburg, had not done an absentee ballot. So we jumped in my little red Mustang and drove down U.S. 19 to St. Pete, about a five-hour drive. We cast our ballot before the polls closed. And then we turned around and drove back to Tallahassee. And so I'll never forget that 76 vote. And I voted for Gerald Ford. A very moderate Republican compared to today's
stand. Well, in fact, Ford would be to the left of many Democrats today.
That's probably true. That's right. Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement.
He was moderate on abortion and many other issues. But at some point in recent vintage, you decided you were not comfortable in the Republican Party, and ultimately you switched to the Democratic Party. What kind of thought process was involved in this?
Well, a lot. You know, observing what was happening in the party and sort of the rise of the Tea Party and how that had a strong influence in particularly Republican primary politics was the first inkling I got of it. I remember as still being governor back in 2009, President Obama was coming to Florida to talk about his stimulus program, the Recovery Act. And his office invited me to greet him in Fort Myers, Florida, which I did, and introduced him. And, you know, he embraced me and I him and his policy. And that was sort of the beginning of it, Jim. Not too long thereafter, I was in a Republican primary for the U.S. Senate with Marco Rubio, who is now our junior senator. And I was at a Republican barbecue. And after I gave my comments, somebody from the back of the room yelled out, "Why don't you go hug Obama again?" And I thought, you know, there's something going on out there that I'm not really used to and not completely comfortable with. And so that was when I first got an inkling that things were changing in the Republican Party, and eventually led me to join the Democratic Party.
Well, President Obama has not fared well running in the South in most states, including Louisiana, although he's done better in Florida than he has here. He actually carried your state. So what does that say about your state and ours, if anything?
Well, probably a couple things. You know, the South generally is pretty red and very Republican for the most part. What has happened in Florida, you're right, the president did win Florida in 2012. He also won Florida in 2008. Florida's an incredibly diverse state, as I'm sure you're probably aware. We have a lot of our population in the southern part of the state, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm, a lot from northeastern part of the country. On the West Coast, where I live, we have a strong influx that is from the Midwest. And throughout the state, we have an awful lot of new people, Hispanics particularly, that have immigrated to Florida. So we have immigrants from within America and immigrants from outside America. And that creates a diversity that is pretty sweeping in its range and a little hard to predict in its politics. You know, we have a Republican governor and a Republican House and Senate here, as you do in Louisiana. Yet we went Democratic in the last two presidential races. So Florida is a purple state, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It swings both ways. And, you know, part of my message Saturday will be to encourage Louisiana Democrats that, you know, a message of greater tolerance and a more welcoming big tent party, if you will, as the Democrats are, I think bodes well for the future, both in Florida and Louisiana.
Dan Downtown. Dan, you're on the air with the 44th Governor of Florida, the Honorable Charlie Crist. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Governor. Now that you've switched parties, have you patched things up with one of your Senate opponents, former Congressman Meeks, who I thought was very impressive?
He is very impressive, and he's a friend and a wonderful guy. And, you know, we had a three-way race in that Senate contest, and Kendrick was a very good Democratic nominee. Obviously, Marco Rubio was the Republican. And I think the way it turned out, Dan, is that Kendrick and I sort of were espousing a very similar point of view on the direction of government. And we ended up kind of splitting our votes. And that's really how Marco won. But no, Kendrick's a great man. He's a great leader. We go back pretty far. I remember I served as education commissioner before attorney general and governor of Florida. And we worked on some issues together with some high schools in his district when he was in the state Senate. And you know probably that his mother was a tremendous member of Congress, serving the same seat that Kendrick later represented very well in Washington.
297-5633, still time to get in. We'll spend a bit more time with Charlie Crist, the former governor of the great state of Florida, and he will be in New Orleans Saturday night at the Jefferson Jackson Affair for Louisiana Democrats, and of course every Democrat who is prominent in Louisiana will be there, including Mary Landrieu, the U.S. Senator, who is seeking a fourth term on Capitol Hill next year against the hard-charging Bill Cassidy, congressman from Baton Rouge. Back in 90 seconds with Governor Charlie Crist. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Charles Joseph Charlie Crist Jr., the former governor of Florida, is with us. He'll be in New Orleans Saturday night, stumping in his way for Louisiana Democrats who are holding their annual Jefferson Jackson dinner. Charlie Crist is a man who, as we noted, is of Greek descent, and he played football in college, correct?
That is true. I played at Wake Forest University before I transferred to Florida State. And but don't be too impressed. I was a mere walk-on quarterback and was lucky enough to make the team and play in some JV games up at Wake.
Well, that's significant. That's major college football, the Atlantic Coast Conference.
Very right.
Miriam,
that's right.
Miriam and Inniswald for Governor Crist. Hi, Miriam.
Hey, good morning. Listen,
good morning,
was that pardon of Jim Morrison, you know, the late iconic rock frontman of the Doors, Jim Morrison, was that a political statement, or do you think, or was that just about being a fan?
I'm not sure it was about you know, a political statement, but Jim Morrison is happened to be a Floridian and grew up not far from me, and also went to Florida State University. But what was brought to my attention, actually by a reporter in Tallahassee, was the fact that, you know, he had never received a conviction. There were some, you know, disorderly conduct at a concert alleged down near Miami in Coconut Grove. And an indecent exposure, I believe, is what it was, as I'm recalling. And there was a conviction in a state court. And then Mr. Morrison appealed the conviction. And while it was on appeal, he passed away over in Europe. And in many states, when that occurs, there is an automatic, you know, situation where that person is exonerated and leads to a pardon. And it occurred to me that our clemency board should at least look at his case and his scenario. And because the appeal hadn't been completed, his name couldn't have been cleared. And there was some evidence that was unclear and circumstantial to a degree in the original case. So I brought it before the clemency board, and they saw fit to join with me and grant him posthumously his pardon. And I think it was the right thing to do.
42 years after his death at 27, it's amazing how many times a week we hear the Doors on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
They did some good work, didn't they?
Phenomenally popular, and you know, had a great run, and it's you know, sad that his ending came as it did, but at least one thing that we were able to do for he and his family, frankly, was to clear up this one part of his past and have him rest in peace a little better.
And Charlie Crist was 14 years old when Jim Morrison passed away in Paris in 1971, long time ago. Barry in Mid-City. Hi, Barry. You're on with Governor Crist.
Yes, Governor, please. I'm just wondering, if hypothetically you were governor of Louisiana with our several hundred thousand poor people who will not be able to get Medicaid under the new Health Care Act because our governor refuses to expand it, if you would take different actions, sir.
I would. And I understand the number's about 400,000. And the reason I know that is, number one, I knew I was going to come on with Jim today, and so I tried to do a little homework. But it, to me, that's a tragedy. And, you know, the federal government, the Obama administration, offered the same thing to Florida as they did to Louisiana. And that's why it's so important. These elections matter so much. The people that are in public policy deciding positions to accept or reject something on behalf of 400,000 in your state, it was over a million, or approximately a million, Floridians that are not benefiting from that expanded Medicaid advantage. And when you think about that, you have to think about people are not getting health care. What happens when they don't get health care? It means that they get sick. And it could even mean that they pass away. And I just don't understand the thought process. People want to save money. I get that. But when it comes to providing health care to the poor, you know, we're the richest country in the world. Frankly, we're the richest country in the history of the world. And, you know, what does it say about us that we won't do unto others in a time of need when they need health care? I don't understand it. So I'm glad you asked the question.
And the governor of Florida has accepted the Medicaid money, hasn't he?
Well, that's a great question. He said that he was for it, but then really didn't lift a finger to get the legislature to adopt it. And so we have officially rejected it as a state. Yeah, yeah. And a lot more leadership and effort could have been brought to bear there, in my view.
Well, and many speculate that you might run for office in your home state again. Would that be a reason to do so?
That would be among the reasons to do so. I think that you know, having somebody in the governor's office that really has your back and really cares about people, the middle class, is pretty darn important, especially during these times.
So you're looking at running, I would presume, as a Democrat.
I am looking at it. Yes, I am, and proudly as a Democrat, if I do. You know, Florida's a great state. I love it with all my heart, and you know, it breaks my heart to see what's happening to some people in the education arena and this healthcare issue that we've just talked about.
So that election, if I remember right, would be next year.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, so if you run, you'll be running at the same time that Senator Landrieu is seeking re-election, and I'm sure you know her. And as far as Deep South senators, she's the only Democrat left. She's the only Democrat left in a statewide office in Louisiana. It would seem on the surface that the odds would be against her, but she's conquered the odds before. What do you think about a person like Senator Landrieu, now 18 years, or soon to be 18 years in the U.S. Senate, trying to hang on as a Democrat in the midst of a sea of red?
I think she'll do fine. I'm very optimistic about Senator Landrieu's chances next year. I think that Louisianans obviously know her and think the world of her, and they realize that they've got in Mary Landrieu, a U.S. senator that is fighting for them every day in Washington and doing the hard work that needs to be done to make sure that that they have somebody who really cares about them first and foremost. And so I'm very optimistic for her chances next year. And, you know, people have said in the past that it may be a tough road to hoe, but Senator Landrieu is a tough fighter and a true public servant. So I think she'll do just fine.
Now, we have a listener who notes that when the Bush-Gore crisis in Florida took place in 2000, you were a Republican then. How did you come down on that?
Well, I was actually on the ballot that day, believe it or not. I was running for Commissioner of Education. It used to be an elected position in Florida. It is not presently. And by the grace of God, my race was not the nail-biter that Bush-Gore was, and I was able to go to sleep the night of the election knowing that I had won. Having said that, we've had problems with elections in Florida. I mean, even the most recent presidential election in the fall, it took a couple, 3 days before people knew the outcome in Florida for President Obama because of some voter suppression, frankly, that had been passed after I left the governor's office. And things like less early voting days and making it more difficult for people to register, even the legal women voters, was discouraged from their usual registration because there were some onerous penalties in that process that were brought to bear and some new laws. So we've got to be vigilant about voters' rights. I mean, we see some really, I think, egregious things happening in North Carolina as we speak to make it more difficult for minorities and young people to register and exercise that precious right to vote. So we always have to fight for that, and I know Floridians will continue to do so.
Well, as we rounded out with Governor Crist, you noted that in Florida you had your fill of aversion to President Obama. How much of the opposition to him all over the country, but in particular in the South, how much do you think that's related to race?
I don't think we can ever know for sure. But I think that some of it, sadly, may be. And, you know, that's unfortunate, and it's wrong. And one of the things that really bothered me after I had been with the president in Fort Myers and embraced he and his policy as it relates to the Recovery Act were some of the comments and the looks that I would get and some of the marketing, frankly, that was utilized in later races as it related to that embrace. And, you know, photographs being used on the cover of envelopes instead of inside in the mailers that would go out. So, again, it's hard to say how much of it is, but to the degree that any of it is based on race, that's something we need to move beyond.
Well, Governor, it's a pleasure to talk with you. We hope you have a good trip to Louisiana and look forward to another conversation sometime soon.
Jim, thank you so much. It's been great to be with you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. You're welcome.
We're joined now by Zach Coplin. He just turned 20 years old. And Zach Coplin, who went to Baton Rouge High along with our governor and lieutenant governor, has been on Real Time with Bill Maher. He's been featured in the Huffington Post, Moyers & Company, MSNBC, Current TV, NPR, Public Radio International, and he even is a columnist for The Guardian. Good morning, Zach Coplin.
Hey, Jim. Thanks so much for having me on. It's always been great.
And you were in Houston at Rice University, where he is a history student, graduate of Baton Rouge High 2011. And Zach, he was even on Science Friday, weren't you?
Yep. And so it's interesting because we lost again in Louisiana this year, 3-2. But right now, we're also worried about the fight over science nationally because, honestly, science denial isn't just a Louisiana problem. We take a bad rap for it here because we're ground zero. But in a way, it's something we should be proud of because we're the ones leading the fight and trying to change things.
All right. And well, so, you're talking about the Science Education Act, which yes. Zach Coplin has tried. He's led the fight to repeal, and he's still doing so. And last year, this year at the legislative session, a move to repeal Austin Committee 3-2 would likely have lost on both floors of the House and Senate, but never got there. There are some who have, like Dan Clater, for example, a Republican, who indicates he would vote your way, but there aren't many out there in front on this issue, Zach, in Louisiana. And the governor says he likes the law. He believes, actually discounts the theory of evolution. And Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, also a Baton Rouge High graduate, on this show said that if he became governor, he would sign a bill to repeal, but he would not lead the fight to repeal. So with that as the backdrop, it would appear that Louisiana will have this law around for a while. What will you do to continue the fight?
I mean, we'll be here for the long run. We're going to keep trying to repeal it year after year. And the key is we are making progress. And the legislators who are against the repeal law don't like the attention that's been brought to it. And so that's the key thing. We're going to make change on this in Louisiana. And while we do that, we're going to try and make change because there's a law that's copying Louisiana's in Tennessee. We're going to try and repeal that law. And there's some other science issues. Climate change is a big one. Our climate is changing, and there's laws. And the Louisiana Science Education Act doesn't just target evolution. It also targets climate change. And there's laws in states like North Carolina where they ask people to deny that climate change is happening when they build buildings on the coastline. And so those are the sort of things we're working on nationally. And there's an important point I want to make, that even though this is national policy, we can actually affect this back home in Louisiana through simple things like voting. There's an upcoming election for the 5th District where one of the candidates, Senator Neil Reiser, a Republican from Monroe, was actually a co-sponsor of the Louisiana Science Education Act, the state's creationism law. And so I would like to see a good pro-science candidate jump in there and run against Senator Reiser, who is, in my mind, the anti-science candidate.
All right. And well, in Louisiana, as you know, when this law passed, there were only a few votes, I think 3 in the entire legislature against it. And there were several co-sponsors, including a Democrat, Ben Nevers.
Yep.
You're going to go after these people, even though they were in an overwhelming majority. You're going to have a lot of targets, Zach.
Well, I would hope so. I'd hope there's an opportunity for a smart pro-science candidate to run in the race, and there's a way I can see that happening, which is really to show the practical benefits of science, and really be the candidate who's going for good, smart investment. And I'd throw a name out there like Mayor Jacques Roy, who I know is very interested in the digital divide in Louisiana, which is really, because this isn't just about, I mean, my big issue is about evolution and biology, but part of this is all about showing people the benefits of good science. And if you're getting out there and fighting for really making sure the rural districts in Louisiana have access to high-quality technology, that's one way to be a pro-science candidate, be publicly out there. And so if it's a candidate like that, maybe Mayor Roy running against Senator Reiser, who is not really that much for science, it could be a really interesting race, and there's a really great way to positively be out there for science, I see.
Well, Zach played a major role in convincing the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education to adopt new life science textbooks, and after they were adopted, the Baton Rouge Advocate wrote an editorial calling Zach the newest giant killer in state education policy. You've gotten much attention over the last few years. I'm sure your phone rang a few times after you were on Real Time with Bill Maher.
Yep, and we're going to keep pushing and pushing in Louisiana and elsewhere until we get legislators and politicians to do the right thing.
Are you calling for any more challenges as far as debate opponents? I think you challenged Michelle Bachmann at one point, didn't you?
Yes, she came down to New Orleans once, and she got asked a few questions. She had once said that Nobel laureates support creationism. She never answered it when we pointed out that we have now 78 opposing the appeal or opposing Louisiana's creationism law. But I don't see any more like that in the near future.
All right. Well, Zach, let's keep in touch. Good luck to you. Thanks. And happy 20th birthday.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me on.
We'll be back tomorrow for J.C. Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.